Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches never changed anything.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
All right, we're still on. This is all this week, and it's Wednesday now. Airbnb week. And today we're giving up. This is a simple formula. We've been talking about, and there's a lot of ways, and I did. A lot of ways, proven ways, blueprints on how to make money on Airbnb. So there's one formula which is based, again, on a tent. All right. And tents can be made from different materials, but one tent, and I'm being super conservative. Okay, because, you know, the people on there, they have tents that make $28,000 a year, $30,000 a year. They have TPs on there. They have TP communities, tent communities. But I took a figure of $5,000 a year. Okay, $5,000 a year. Let's divide $5,000. Divide that into 52. So that's like $96 a week. Let's just round it up to $100 a week. So $5,000. And if you do that 50 times, okay, and think of it as you're giving yourself a raise. All right. Each time you do this with a tent, you can increase your income on the low end by $5,000. If you did that 50 times in a year, you've got a gross revenue of $250,000. Okay. Now, the lady that we referred to throughout the week on Airbnb, the tent, she spent less than $300, but let's put it at $300. But $300 for a tent. So, you know, let's say you don't have money to get, you know, 50 tents, you know, all at once, which is understandable. So, let's price them at 50 tents times $300. That's $15,000. All right. So you can slow walk it and keep most of the profits yourself, or you can have, you know, get some partners, maybe you know somebody who's got $15,000. Okay. Now, that's with 50. Now, if you bought a total of 200 tents, and each tent on average brought you in $5,000 a year, okay, that's $100 a week, you gross $1 million in a year with 200 tents. More than likely, you're going to need some partners with that. Okay. Now, there's some other fees, but those vary depending on how you set yourself up. But the tent itself, and depending on what you make, you know, the tent out of the material. Anyway, but that's a basic formula. So I would suggest if you want to get some great, I consider them blueprints, go to Airbnb videos on YouTube as well. And then check out, look, a month ago, I wasn't even thinking about tents. And I got one. I've been sitting on one for like 4 years. But look at tent business models. Keep in mind that, you know, it's an acre of diamonds concept. And which means acres of diamonds. And I'm going to look that up. The tent communities. And you know what? As you know, you have some cities that people have set up tent cities. What I would do, because one of the tent business models that are on Airbnb is they have the space, but they tell you BYOT, bring your own tent. All right. Let's see. Now we're going to have a house rent business model, which means you got to build a bare minimum of 11. And this could be cabins, tents, or a hybrid, because they're hybrid buildings that are a combination of a canvas tent and cabin, or even house. I've seen them. Let's see. And then you can even probably solve some of your personal finance problems. Some of you people, you don't need a lawyer. You need a hacker, a housing hacker. And that's what I would call Ansel Troy, who's been on here a couple of times. If you have that hacker mindset, because lawyers don't think like hackers, house hackers. And a math teacher, basically, because that's all I did. I took, you know, I went on Airbnb, and I saw the woman who makes, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 off of a tent in her backyard. They got other people on there, too. And or you can put in any search engine, Airbnb tents. So there's plenty of examples, and a lot of these people are accessible via social media. So I just, you know, instead of $28,000, let me lower it down And I put it up, you know, $100 a week, $400 a month. $5,000 a year, you know. And I said, well, if I did that 50 times, because we can set up a tent. I got a 10-person tent I'm looking at right now. The 10-person tent can be set up in less than an hour. If you got experience, you know, and a couple of people, let's say 3 or 4 people, you can set this 10-person tent up in less than 30 minutes. All right. So where was I going with you've got people out there that are living in these tent cities. You know, that might be a good place to, because as some of these cities take them down, you know, because you do have some of those people that are in these tent cities are the working homeless. They have transportation. They have an income. And they just want a safe place to park and live. And Mongolia, a certain percentage of the population of Mongolia lives in yurts. Yurts are tents. They're ancient. People have been living in tents for over 1,000 years in Mongolia. And I think maybe about 30 to 40% of Mongolia it's a yurt culture, a tent culture. They have modern buildings just like, you know, any Western country, although they're in Asia. But let's see. Well, anyway, Acres of Diamonds, we'll be back in a few minutes.
Back in the year 1843, a man was born who, during his lifetime, was to have a profound effect on literally millions of people. His name was Russell Herman Conwell. He became a lawyer, then a newspaper editor, and finally a clergyman in 1881. It was during this latter period that an incident occurred which was to change his life and the lives of countless others. One day a group of boys came to Dr. Conwell at his church and asked him if he would be willing to instruct them in college courses. They wanted a college education but lacked the money to attend. He told them he'd do all he could, and as the boys left, a thought, an idea began forming in Dr. Conwell's mind. He asked himself, why couldn't there be a fine college for poor but deserving young men? Here was a great idea, and he went to work on it at once. Almost single-handedly, Dr. Conwell raised between $6 and $8 million with which he founded the now well-known Temple University of Philadelphia. It was how he raised this money that I want to tell you about. He raised the money by giving lectures all over the country, more than 6,000 of them, and in each he told a story called Acres of Diamonds. This was a true story which had affected him very deeply, just as it affected his audiences. It was the story of a farmer who had settled in Africa. This farmer had heard the exciting stories of other African settlers who had made millions by discovering diamond mines. Realizing the African continent was rich in diamonds, the farmer could hardly wait to sell his farm and search for diamonds himself. He spent the rest of his life wandering the vast African continent, searching for the gleaming gems which brought such high prices on the markets of the world, but without success. Finally, in a sudden fit of despondency, broke and desperate, as I remember the story, he threw himself into a river and drowned. During this time, the man who had bought his farm one day found a large and unusual stone in the stream which cut through the property. It turned out to be a great diamond of enormous value, and then he discovered that his farm was covered with them. It was to become one of the world's richest diamond mines. Now, the first farmer had owned literally acres of diamonds, but had sold them for practically nothing in order to look for them elsewhere. If he had only taken the time and study to know what diamonds looked like in their rough state and had first thoroughly explored the land he had owned, he would have had the millions he sought, right on the land he had been living upon. What so profoundly affected Dr. Conwell and subsequently thousands of others was the obvious fact that each of us is at this moment standing in the middle of his own acres of diamonds. if we will only have the wisdom and patience to intelligently and effectively explore the work in which we are now engaged, we will usually find that it contains the riches we seek, whether they be financial or intangible or both. Before we go running off to what we think are greener pastures, let's make sure that our own is not just as green, or perhaps even greener. While we're looking at other pastures, other people are looking at ours. There's nothing more pitiful to my mind than the person who wastes his life running from one thing to another, like the first farmer, forever looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and never staying with one thing long enough to find it. For no matter what your goal may be, the road to it can be found somewhere in the work in which you now find yourself. It wasn't until he was completely paralyzed, for example, and was forced to reach into the resources of his mind, that a Wisconsin farmer got the idea of producing exceptionally good meat products on his farm, and one of the country's largest meatpacking companies was born. His farm contained acres of diamonds, too. He had just never seen them before. A paper salesman found a dirty drinking glass in his hotel room and gave his company the idea of manufacturing paper cups, an idea that solved his financial problems for life. An insurance man got the idea of going back to all the people in his files and really working with them, serving them the way they should be served. That year, he wrote an additional $700,000 of insurance, made the million-dollar roundtable, and found he no longer had to approach cold prospects, that by working with the people he had already sold and on their referrals, he had acres of diamonds right in his filing cabinet. A man out west amassed a fortune with a single small gas station. In the beginning, when things were tough, he would ask himself each morning, "What can I do to increase my service to my customers?" He still asks that question of himself each morning when he gets up, and while he could have retired years ago a wealthy man, he continues to dominate the business in his area by thinking of new and better ways to be of service. Do you know what the so-called average man would have done in this last case? He would have been worried about how bad business was, because in the beginning my friend had a hard time just feeding his family. When one day a man would have driven in the station in a big shiny car, this average man, seeing the wealthy customer, would have said to himself, "I ought to be in his business instead of mine." You see, the average man believes some businesses are better than others, instead of realizing the truth that there are no bad businesses. There are just those people who do not know enough to see the opportunities in the work they're in. Jobs don't have futures. People do. No matter what our work happens to be, it's our business. We're its manager. If we can see no future or opportunity in it, it isn't because it's not there, but only because we can't see it. One time another farmer poked a tiny pumpkin into an empty 1-gallon jug. The pumpkin grew until it completely filled the jug and could grow no more. When it was ripe, the farmer broke the glass jug and had a pumpkin which had assumed the jug's exact shape. In life, each of us does a similar thing. We poke ourselves into jugs of our own deciding, and we can grow no larger. But let's be mature enough to realize that it is we who do the poking, not the job, nor the company, nor the territory, nor the economy, nor the times. We do it. We should dispense with limitations and realize there is virtually no limit to our growth and development on the land on which we now find ourselves. Above all, keep this thought in mind as often as you can, on and off the job. Somewhere within the work you are now doing, there lurks an opportunity which will bring you everything you could possibly want for yourself and your family. In closing, here are 12 points to remember. 1. If we will develop the wisdom and patience to intelligently and effectively explore the work in which we are now engaged, we will find it contains the riches, tangible and intangible, we seek. 2. Before we go running off to what we think are greener pastures, let's realize our own pasture is unlimited. 3. That there are no bad jobs, but that it's the way in which we go about our work which makes it good or bad. 4. That we poke ourselves into jugs beyond which we cannot grow. Let's remove the limitations we've set upon ourselves. 5. That only preparation can ensure our taking advantage of the opportunities which will present themselves in the future, opportunities which are around us now. 6. Put your imagination to work on the many ways and means of improving what you're now doing. 7. Learn all you can about your job, your company, and your industry. 8. Since there's no limit to the growth of your industry, it must follow there is similarly no limit on your growth potential within that industry. 9. Our dynamic and growing economy needs and will well reward the uncommon man who seeks a place in this growth. 10. Begin to build your library of reference material pertaining to your company, industry, job, and on how to better serve and get along with people. 11, set aside an hour a day for this study and research. And 12, remember the story of the Acres of Diamonds. This is Earl Nightingale. Thank you.
Okay, I had my mic off and had to repopulate my phone. Okay, today we're talking about $5,000 Airbnb tent. Now, it doesn't have to be on Airbnb. It can be anywhere you want to market it. Instagram, OfferUp, Craigslist, Facebook Live. So it doesn't have to be Airbnb. I'm just, Airbnb's got quite a few people that are making money, though. How one $5,000 tent, and that, we're talking about a yearly income, okay, how one $5,000 Airbnb tent, or tent on Airbnb, or any platform that you market on, multiply that times 50, you can take in a yearly income of $250,000 with 50 tents. More than like now, 50 is, yeah, you might, you're going to need at least one person to help you out, if not more, depending on how you set it up. And we play Acres of Diamonds because that goes into line with, I mean, if you got a backyard and you order a tent from Amazon or go to Walmart and pick up a tent, you can get started like today, you know. You know, rent it out. Which way you want. Now, there are different materials that you can make it out of. I mean, there's people have made, I mean, typically when you think of a tent, you think about a structure made of cloth, canvas. But they also have tents made from wood and different types of plastic, even metal. Because it all depends on how you define it. A teepee, Native American, that's a tent. And they basically, they move with the seasons. They move, Native Americans traditionally move with the seasons. So a tent kept them warm. It was, and they made all weather tents. So cold climate, I don't know how many, I had to do some research on it. Often some of those Native Americans, you know, because they move with the seasons, they move with the food, and their tent, that, you know, they can just disassemble it and move on to the next place. Now, today in 2023, you have people that are living in cars, living in vans, getting school buses and converting those, they call them schoolies, into homes, houses on wheels. You have people doing RVs that, you know, and then you also have people that have, and I have to look it up, but they're backpackers, okay? So I imagine I imagine somebody's got a backpack where they have their portable tent right within that backpack. Because one of the common denominators, and I've hung out with some backpackers when I was up in Vermont a few years ago. And, you know, some of these people, they were doing the Appalachian Trail. I mean, people from all over Europe and what have you. Well, the common denominator I know is that when you meet a 20-something-year-old and they've been to, or either they've been to every country in the world or they're well on their way, some of the common denominators that I've run into is, number one, they don't have a mortgage payment. That's number one. They're not settled with that 15, 20, 30-year debt. Number two, they're not associated with any maintenance that you're going to run into on a house. Number three, they didn't have a car, but they were able to get to any country that they wanted to, not only to that country, but in around. So it's you know, it all depends on, you know, what kind of lifestyle you want to lead. Now, I think, matter of fact, I'm going to do some forecasting here, that you're going to see more and more tent communities pop up. And here's why I'm saying that. Now, let's look at this historically. Go across to Asia, to Mongolia. And you can fact check me online with this. The Mongolian, culture, yurts, spelled Y-U-R-T. Some people spell it Y-E-R-T. But yurts, and you can get yurts in this country. But in the Mongolian culture, and I'll read it right here, yurts today are still most often associated with the country of Mongolia. In fact, the word ger, G-E-R, itself means home or household in Mongolian. Today, more than half of Mongolians live in gers, also known as yurts, including about 61% of the capital of Mongolia, Ulaanbaatar. 61% in and 90% of Mongolia has a rural population. Now, 95 to 97% of the United States is rural. We got, like I said, I've repeated it over and over and over again. 88% of the population of the United States occupies 3 to no more than 5% of the land, total land mass. All right. So once again, 61% in their capital live in yurts and live in tents. And that's one of the world's capital cities, Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. All right, now, what else do we have here? All right. Now, I don't know how many tent cities in the United States, but tent cities in USA. All right, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Las Cruces, New Mexico, St. Louis, Missouri, Honolulu, Hawaii, Seattle, Washington, Indianapolis, all feature encampments for the homeless. See, what I would suggest people do, every city that I'm going to name, find some city about 30 to 90 minutes away from that place, buy you some land by the acre, and then start to, you know, where you can do it legally, a tent community. Anyway. Seattle has even declared a state of emergency on homelessness. Now, it's real bad in King County. That's where Seattle is, Washington. It's in King County, Washington State. I would look at counties, give yourself a two-county radius of King County and buy some land. Matter of fact, any of these places I just named, some of these places you might do more. You might do more than the two county radius. Okay. Anyway, list of 10 cities in the United States. Here's what we got. And this is because most of the 10 cities that exist are not even on the radar. They got them in San Francisco, Washington D.C., Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I've been there a few times. Las Cruces, nice area of the country. Let's see, Honolulu, Hawaii, Seattle, Washington, Indianapolis, Indiana. They call them encampments. Okay, now they have, these are the more organized ones, I guess. Camp Hope in Las Cruces, Dignity Village in Portland, Oregon, Camp Quixote, Olympia, Washington, Camp Tahoe, that's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Opit Village, Joe Rocha Trail, that's in Santa Rosa, California. Maricopa County, they list 27. There's probably about 500 to 1,000 more tent cities, or encampments as they call them, listed. And the people that we had on here about 5 months ago, four months ago, we have them this year. Let's see, in the close five. Freedom Georgia, the Freedom Georgia Initiative. They start out with 97 acres of land, and they're up to 502. But the first type of housing that they put up on their land, the 97 acres that they started out with, the original 97 acres, tents. Tents. So we met, you know, and if you look at the historic towns, if you look at the history of a lot of the towns that were built in the United States, a lot of towns, including some of your mega big cities now, started off with somebody pitching a tent. Or doing a dugout out of the earth. But a lot of it just started with a tent. You know, let's look up some of the histories of the United States, how a lot of those towns started. One or two people and a tent. So if it's good, if that strategy has worked, Jesus, forever, we'll do the same thing. All right, and we'll grow from there. Okay, we don't have much time today. We got a few minutes. I'll go to the phone lines because we got to, we're lining up stuff. Friday we have an in-studio guest because this is Airbnb week, so we'll have an Airbnb person that used to be a host. I think he's going to go back to it. But he's got plenty of experience with Airbnb. And the one thing we've hung our nail on is we're going to be dealing with building, because I like the BYOT business model for tents. All right. We provide the space. You provide your tent. So we'll be building decks, carports. I'm going to even do a social experiment that I know somebody who's homeless. He's been on here a couple of times. And, matter of fact, I'm going to talk to him today and say, look, man, he's in North Carolina. Because he's asking for money, but he's getting it. And he gets people to give him money, I guess, most days he gets something. I pitch him a couple of, you know, dollars here and there. But I'm going to say, look, you know, either you find a spot or we can find a spot for him. You know, use his skills to help him get a tent. You know, take some of that donation money, get a tent, okay. And, you know, because he's living in, last time I spoke to him, he's living in Sheets, which is like, a gas station in Many Mart. So we'll see if we can do a social experiment with that. He's been out there for like 3 or 4 years, homeless. So he's collected more than enough money to get a tent. So that's one of the things we're going to do. All right, 309 area code. We got 10 minutes before we have to shut off early for today. What do you got for me, 309?
Well, good morning, and I got a happy birthday for you.
Thank you.
I can't wait to say that to you personally instead of texting you. I want to say
appreciate it. Appreciate it. I've gone around the sun 66 times.
66
so far.
Look at that.
Yes, so far.
That's right. So far, let's see that 100 mark come around, and we'll discuss it on the other part. But
I had a great grandmother that I think she made it to 102, and I had an aunt. My mother's oldest sister that made it to 105, and I had a next door neighbor up in D.C. who just passed away maybe a month ago, if that. She made it to 103.
Wow. And, I'm getting to meet a lady, and actually you might have a caller in right now from the Colorado area, 303, I think is his area code. Hang on, I'll tell you what his area code is. 303.
Well, whoever gets,
so you do get a 303. He has a 103-year-old mother.
Okay, all right, that's excellent. Yeah, but anybody listening, just press 1, and we'll get you up into the conversation. And whatnot. So hold on a minute, Chris. We got another caller here. 407 area code, your mic is open. 407 going once.
Good day. This is Beata from Female Solution Blog Talk Radio, and greetings to your callers. And I just called to wish you a happy Earth Day. 66 around the sun, good number. You're on a roll. Keep it going.
Right. You know what, matter of fact, this year for 66, well, we already got to do something on Christmas Day. What do you call it? Christmas Eve. That's day of 100. But I'm going to make it a new habit of mine as a birthday present to myself based on the house rent, some kind of way build, for each year, build that number of new housing. That's a tall order. But I'm going to start with 10.
That's a tall order.
Yeah, that's a tall order. But there, I know of a guy out in I don't know where he lives. His name is Tom Saray. That guy last June or July built. Now, he had help now. He didn't do it by himself. But he subcontracted out. He built 10,000 sheds in a month. 10,000. So if he can do that, I can do 66. But I'll need help to do it. I'm a copy off of him. Partner up. Anyway, Viola, thank you for that Earth Day thing. So now, for people that are not familiar with you, and because you've lived in a tiny house, and then you've converted a shed into a tiny house. Matter of fact, what did you get more pleasure out of, your first tiny house to live in, or converting that shed into a tiny house?
Well, I think I learned more on converting the shed, into tiny house because I had to actually add plumbing and a room and painting. I didn't have to do that with my tiny house on wheels. And when I first moved in there, it was all constructed, painted, and everything. All I had to do was move it to the rural area. So this, the one I'm in now, but converted, that was had the most lessons for me on actually converting and making it livable space. And then my grandchildren are here in their dad's house across their yard, and that's made it even more interesting. And then the things that were provided for me to convert this house were also very synchronistic and divine in nature, because having my ex-husband and his son put a new roof on an empty shed was like, why are they doing that? And then I end up living in it a year later. It's like, whoa. And then having tiles that were sitting in this shed for like 20 years, I ended up using those around my bathtub. So these were the signs that it was meant for me to be living in this space that I occupy now. But I'm excited about go ahead.
No, you're excited about what?
About the things that I'm doing today to help people and sharing with you in this mission to help simplify people's lives and help them see the options they have for living space. Doesn't have to be a three-bedroom, five-bed bathroom, three-car garage mansion. We are done with that if you have consciousness. And unless you have a huge family, there's no need for these big mansions anymore. There's plenty of them available to rent or live in if you need that, but we want to give people a new desire to go smaller, not bigger.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And to do to do minimalism, you have to let go.
How many square feet would be your son's house?
Well, he's twice, at least probably two or three. He's got three bedrooms. I only have one here, and mine's 320. So he's over 1,000 for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, over 1,000. Don't know how much, but he's got three bedrooms, two baths, and a living room, dining room, kitchen.
Okay, Chris, just a guess, to replace a roof, because if you get a house, you're going to have to replace that roof eventually. On a 1,000-square-foot house, what do you think the cost of a new roof would be?
Well, right now, you know, roofing is about $200 a square to buy the material for a metal roof. Now, a metal roof will give you a true 60-year warranty. Asphalt roof, when you buy asphalt shingles, they'll say, hey, this is a 50-year shingle. Okay?
Right.
The warranty on that shingle is only 15 years.
Right.
They're saying that it could last 50, but they're not going to guarantee it. Now, on a metal roof, you truly get a lifetime out of it. There's two different kinds of metal roofs and I like the standing seam roof. The standing seam roof, it shows no fasteners. That was the only weak part to the metal roof, is the fasteners. The rubber washers, when you fasten down the nut head that holds that siding did you hear me? When that rubber washer that's on the screw that attaches the roof, over a period of time, that rubber will dry up. And it will cause a leak to start coming into the building. So if you do, when you look at people's barns and things that they build, and you look up there and you see the lines of screws, the one thing that they'll have to do, and you can go up there and do it, is go up there and silicone every one of them. Because that's going to give you some added protection to get up there and cover over everyone in the screws. But now you got a bunch of uglies across your roof. You don't want that. So if you get a standing seam roof, all of the fasteners are hidden so you don't see them. So when everything goes together, it's more like a snap lock system. So it's a better roof than for the premium. It's worth $40 for a 10-foot by 10-foot area to put that premium on there to not have to worry about it.
Okay, I have a question for Chris about a metal roof.
And they now have metal roofs that look like asphalt shingles. So
Chris,
you can actually,
you got a question,
like shape roof. What was that?
I've got a question to ask you.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a metal roof on my 160 square tiny house on wheels, and it was really hard to get used to the noise when it rained. Is there any way to reduce the noise on a metal roof when the rain comes?
Definitely. Put OSB underneath it and then fasten it to the OSB. Okay. Then spray foam the ceiling.
Okay.
Right,
so
to the rafter,
right
to the rafter on the inside of it. Get you cell one. And what it'll do is it's going to insulate, and it ain't going to let the heat come through that roof at all into your attic area. So you're not getting any bleed through, but it will deaden the sound.
Okay.
So it does come down to whether or not you wrap it or not.
Now, what exactly is OSB? What is OSB?
Oriented strand board. It's a plywood.
Okay.
Have you got plywood on your ceiling now?
Well, I don't have a metal roof. So I have a regular tile roof. So, but in my previous house, that's why I wouldn't want to go with a metal roof because of the noise. But if there was some way to reduce the noise, like you said, I would go with a metal roof. So thank you. I'll share that with others. The difference between...
Definitely. And remember this. When you're coming to soundproofing something, they make a thing called RC channel. And it's a metal channel that you would put on the wall and mount it to the stud. You just screw it to the studs. And on one side of it, it just hangs. But you hang your sheetrock to it. Instead of attaching to your trusses, you attach to this RC channel. You can do it on the walls, in between apartments or whatever. And by even staggering studs, so, like, if I was going to do a duplex, instead of me having one center wall down the center of it, and it being what it is, I would have a 6-inch track with 3.5-inch studs and have them staggered. So that way, whatever's happening on that wall over there on them studs ain't going through the wall on my other side. So you stagger studs. That's one way to change, you know, sound. So, you know, it might not just be raindrops that could be bothering you, but your neighbors or the ones underneath you. So, like, if you have an apartment, you got people living above you, put RC channel on the ceiling down below, and when they vibrate the floor upstairs, it won't vibrate through your sheetrock.
Well, I'm not even concerned about that. I don't have neighbors underneath. I have a possum. You know, I have an opossum come through here, and my house is a space underneath, and that possum goes under there and just knocks things over, like, and I hear him under there, but otherwise I don't have any human neighbors underneath.
Right. But I've got designs where there are units above each other. So You know, I live in an apartment complex right now, and I'm in the upper apartment. But I know that if there was kids running through this apartment, my neighbors downstairs would hear them, because they did not build these apartments with the soundproofing the way they should have.
Okay.
Even though they're new construction, people don't always do it because they might not want to add $10,000 to the cost of this building to put an extra thing of metal in here so that everybody's peaceful.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably a common cost-cutting procedure. Don't do anything to create less sound upstairs.
But if you care about the people, if you care about people and the well-being of how peaceful is their life going to be, I'm a professional sheetrocker. So when I walk into a building, if they did not have it and it's not on the design, they're not doing it, I would suggest it. I'm like, all right, you know, why don't we do the divider walls with it and put it on the ceiling? I said, we don't have to put it on the top floor, so you're saving the top floors, but this is a three-story building. So there's two floors of people, of sound that's above them. I said, then you have all your units that are connecting. So let's do all the outer walls that connect units so that when somebody's on the other side and they're listening to their stereo, their stereo sound is not coming through this wall. And they did it. So, you know, I wouldn't hardly do an apartment building without RC Channel. And it's just because I'm a professional at what I do, and I want to give you the best job that I possibly can. So, you know, I learned some of those ways of soundproofing. They've got many of those things. They even got a rubber strip you can stick on things. But the best thing I've seen is the RC channel and insulation and staggering studs. You do those things there, you can be jammed. I've made sound rooms where it is so loud in that room that you would have to have earphones on to be able to be in there, and you can't hear nothing just looking at it. You're just looking at it. You're looking through a window, and you can't hear nothing. So there is a way. You can soundproof anything. I built an 1,800-square-foot building that's 12 foot tall, all metal framing, and he has a recording studio that he records every one of his commercials for his business in that building. There's no roof in it or no ceiling in it, no walls in it. It's all metal studs. You look at it, you see all the trusses, you see everything. But I built him one room over in the corner and soundproofed it. And that's where he does all of his music recording.
Viata, what do you got for Friday?
Friday, I will be talking about food sovereignty, about the indigenous food sovereignty plan, and the non-food that we have spreading across the land in even America. So that's my topic for Friday on health and well-being with Viata. It's been brought to my attention of how even organic food is not very sustaining, nutritious, and so forth. So there's independent food sovereignty promoted by Native Americans that I'm going to talk about.
Okay, all right. And Chris, you got a Zoom call. Can you post that on the Facebook page?
Yes, I will.
Okay, thanks a lot. We're cutting it short by about an hour today because we're lining up to do live streams of all these projects we got going. So on that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.